This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC and Chair of the Cardiovascular Management Section Leadership Council at the American College of Cardiology. The CV Management Section is pleased to host the podcast series Practice Made Perfect, which will focus on non-clinical competencies related to leadership skills, professional identity, operational skills, and personal balance. We hope you'll join us every other week as we learn from experts in the field who will remind us that practice makes perfect.
My name is Garima Sharma. I'm a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and I'd like to welcome our audience today joining us for this podcast from the American College of Cardiology Practice Made Perfect series. Our discussants today come from different backgrounds, but both bring a wealth of knowledge on our topic today, which is medical professionalism. First, we have Dr. Martha Gulati. Dr. Gulati is a chief of cardiology for the University of Arizona College of Medicine at Phoenix. Dr. Gulati leads educational activities in cardiovascular sciences for medical students, residents, and fellows at the university, and also serves as the program director for the cardiology fellowship program. She is the editor-in-chief of CardioSmart, which is a patient-centered educational initiative of the American College of Cardiology. She has a very large international following on Twitter and has authored many articles on cardiovascular disease in women, in addition to publishing a best-selling book entitled Saving Women's Hearts. Joining Dr. Gulati is Dr. John Irvin III. Dr. Irvin currently serves as a clinical professor of medicine and as the chair of Department of Internal Medicine in University of Texas A&M. Dr. Irvin has an international reputation as an expert in fields of clinical cardiology, valvular heart disease, and quality improvement. He has served on several national committees of the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. He has previously served as the assistant dean of the continuing medical education at Texas A&M. Currently, he's also the chair of the ACC core curriculum sessions for the annual scientific sessions and is a member of the Integrated Learning Committee. Thank you both so much for joining us today. So our topic today is medical professionalism. We have a wide audience for these podcasts, so let's start by defining briefly our topic. Dr. Gulati, I would like to start with you.
Thanks for having me here, Garima. It's my pleasure to be on this podcast with you. And the American Board of Medical Specialties has actually defined medical professionalism for us, and it's something we encounter every day in our clinical practice. Every day there's ethical dilemmas that test our professionalism, and of course everyone has a learning curve, so it's part of our training for our fellows in training, but it's also the more you've dealt with it, hopefully the better at it. So formally, medical professionalism is a belief system about how to best organize and deliver healthcare. Medical professionalism essentially is a set of values, behaviors, and relationships. Specifically, it includes integrity, compassion, altruism, continuous improvement, excellence, duty, and communication, and working in partnership with members of the wider healthcare team. For medical professionalism to function effectively, there must be an interactive and legitimate method to debate, define, declare, distribute, and ultimately enforce the shared values and ethical values that medical professionals agree must govern medical work. There are publicly professed oaths. We all took them usually when we graduated from medical school. There's codes, charters, curricula, and perhaps more tangible are the articulation of this through explicit core competencies for medical professional practice. For example, with the ACGME core competencies, we have and we're often asked to assess our fellows' professionalism. So basically, by making our standards explicit and sharing them with the public and enforcing them is how our profession maintains its standing as being worthy of public trust. Dr. Irvin, do you have other things to add to that, especially with your background in medical education and designing core competency curricula for the American College of Cardiology?
Well, Garima, I want to also thank you for allowing me to participate with you and Martha today, and I can never add anything to what Martha gives. But I'm gonna try and just maybe expand a little bit upon that. Learning medical professionalism is very challenging. It's evolving with our medical society and the healthcare environment that we live in at the current time, and it really is a lifelong endeavor. The ACGME did implement 6 competencies of care, which include patient care, medical knowledge, professionalism, interpersonal and communication skills, and systems-based practice, as well as practice-based learning and improvement. And that's been present since 1999. Currently, we have unprecedented challenges arising from increasing expectations of professionalism from patients, healthcare managers, and the government. And that's why the ACGME mandates that medical professionalism be taught at every level of training. The ACGME guidelines clearly states that the learner must demonstrate an understanding of professionalism, so reading and other passive exercises themselves are not going to be adequate to do this. One would argue, really, that this is a pillar of non-clinical competencies and should be formally incorporated into training programs across the country. It's actually a requirement at this point. But providing timely and constructive feedback to learners and assessing their conscientiousness has to be a routine part of medical education across the spectrum. Medical schools and residency and fellowship training programs should also be addressing this formally by designing workshops and other active learning mechanisms that address all the pillars that Dr. Gulati and I just mentioned.
Absolutely. That's just a fantastic overview, and I thank you both for that. That certainly covered a lot of ground, right, from defining medical professionalism to the ACGME core competencies versus many ways to actually be able to provide that for our learners. As clinicians, how can we approach our daily work schedule through the lens of medical professionalism? Perhaps I can give you a typical scenario, and each of you can suggest ways we can incorporate concepts of medical professionalism. Dr. X is an interventional cardiologist that is known for really tough structural interventional cases. He performs very high-risk cases and is known for his tough, no-nonsense demeanor. He has taken on a case of an 89-year-old patient for a TAVR who is extremely frail and suffers from several comorbidities. He, unfortunately, during the procedure, has a complication leading to death on the table due to pericardial damponade. Dr. X fails to take ownership of the problem, and he does not meet the family members for an extended period of time. He does meet them briefly, and then says that this was a very well-recognized procedural complication and that she was too frail to have undergone the case. He documents the note in the chart, and then he asks his interventional cardiology fellow to field the questions from the family while he continues on with his next case. Dr. Urban, how would you recommend we approach such a scenario with the pillars of medical professionalism in mind?
And I know that this is purely a hypothetical case because this never happens, right? Unfortunately, for too long in medicine, we've allowed those people who are technically proficient to behave in manners such as this, and this type of behavior has to be called out because what we allow, we actually encourage. And so this would just really highlight the point that before we can really teach fellows and medical students and residents this, we have to teach the teachers how to do this the right way. This doc is clearly modeling behavior that we don't want our fellows to learn and continue to incorporate into their practice. And so it has to be called out. And for a senior physician to essentially place the blame on the patient themselves when a bad outcome occurs, in this particular case, this is someone acting as a technician, not as a professional. And so I think this illustrates quite well what we're talking about when we're calling out unprofessional behavior. And it has to be addressed with the attending, and this has to be a learning moment for this fellow to understand how to address this in a more appropriate way in the future.
Great. Excellent advice. Dr. Gulati, what would you add to that?
Well, like John said, this is a scenario, unfortunately, that we do see, and not just specifically an interventionalist, but honestly, in cardiology now, I think people are sometimes, you know, not necessarily taking the time with our patients, specifically when some things are more technical. And I think that we have to remember that we're examples to our fellows, and we're always teaching. If you're part of that teaching community, no matter what, when you have trainees of any level, our behavior will then be taught to the next generation. I don't even know, to be honest, if any of us would see that, right? Because it might be that the fellow sees it, but do they report it to us? So it's always that complicated, you know, what actually happened. But obviously, we have a responsibility to the patient. We have a responsibility to that patient's family. We have a responsibility to our trainee. And there's a lot of reasons why this behavior might be in the specific case. You know, we know that there's a lot more burnout in our physicians, but we hope this isn't a repeated behavior either. But I think we need to talk more in our community about these exact scenarios, and not just for our fellows, but reaccreditation. Should professionalism be part of our reaccreditation process? And I think that, you know, the other things that come into here is that we are never just technicians, and the patient is part of it, their family. Our whole idea around shared decision making is so vital, because if it is something we expect to happen, I hope that the patient and the family knew that that was part of what they were signing up for. Again, I hope that if fellows are listening to this, that they will recognize that that is not normal. That shouldn't happen, that behavior. It is not their responsibility to go explain to the family a bad outcome. And in fact, part of their training should be watching someone deliver this unfortunate news and be able to convey it with the greatest compassion that our patients and their families deserve.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. There was definitely a lot to break down in that clinical scenario, and I so appreciate both of you taking different aspects of this vignette and breaking it down for our audience. In addition to that, I would like to also bring in another clinical scenario, perhaps in the realm of social media and medical education on social media, which we all know is pretty rampant and pretty prevalent out there. Let me give you a case. A fellow in training, known for medical education, makes an excellent clinical vignette, and actually is known for making these clinical vignettes and teaching on Cardio Twitter. He uses his own patients that he has seen on the cardiology consult and does take permission from them prior to posting their information. However, he's sometimes forgetful and does not de-identify the patient's echocardiographic films in this particular case. While posting the clinical vignette, he also makes remarks about how the diagnosis was very challenging and was missed early on. After his clinical vignette is posted on Cardio Twitter, he gets many responses on social media, and one of them is the patient herself. You know, rightfully so, she's offended that her case was discussed, even though she had given permission, particularly because she finds out that several other cardiologists had missed her diagnosis. Her information was not declassified. The fellow is also seen to be engaging in personal remarks against the Cardio Twitter users who have offered a different diagnosis. So let me start off with Dr. Gulati. How would you break this down?
This is a big issue, and you know, we like social media for so many reasons. It's immediate, it's responsive, it can be helpful in our medical practice, it can be a wonderful way for us to make friends, as all three of us are friends on social media as well as in real life. But I think we have to know how to use it, right, and always protect our patients. So I think the one thing is you know, de-identifying patients is the first and foremost thing that you must do if you're going to post it. But even before that, you need to know your hospital policy, because if you don't know your hospital policy, they might not allow you to use any patient information that even has their hospital name on it. So you better make sure, if you want your job, you might want to know what your policy is before you even enter it. You certainly, when you're posting patient information, don't forget they're out there too. You can't block necessarily necessarily people from seeing something. They may not be able to answer you, but they still can see all the stuff posted and reposted and retweeted. If you do it the day after the patient left, they might definitely clue in that it's them regardless. And even with their permission, sometimes these conversations can lead to, did you make the right diagnosis? You know, was it wrong? So you want to protect everyone, including yourself, about that, as well as your hospital and as well as the patient. A great case was in some town, there was somebody who had a shark bite. Even though they didn't post the patient's information because it was a small town, the patient saw the picture on, I don't know, I think it was on Facebook. They saw their own shark bite. It traumatized them. They ended up suing, I don't remember if they sued the hospital, but the doctor actually had some repercussions for posting it. I don't think they lost their job, but they definitely, maybe they had a brief suspension because basically the patient was able to identify themselves in that way. So again, be very careful. Remember that we're excited to share good things, but we want to make sure that we're always thinking about the patient first, because remember, that's what we do every day. I think there's other things that go on, as this case demonstrated, when you disparage other people's opinion or treat them either not nicely or with some hostility on Twitter. Again, people will see that. Your patients will see that, whether it's the patient that you're discussing or other people. So the things I always say is, you know, would you say that to your mother? If you wouldn't, you probably shouldn't put it out there in Twitter. Would you say it to those people if you were face-to-face? Because we do see different personalities emerge somehow on social media than they would ever do if they were face-to-face. That immediacy, that responsiveness, you need to be careful. You're also a doctor in that public domain, and you must never forget that. You must be professional. And then I always use the rule, just be kind. People are entitled to different opinions, and there's ways to respond, saying, I didn't think of that, we don't believe it was that diagnosis, and maybe giving them the reason why. So, you know, we want to use social media for good, we don't want to use it for bad, and so hopefully we're thinking about the patient first, treating the issue, then we move on to what are the exciting things we might share with our community.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think the same principles of integrity and compassion and continuous improvement and excellence that we demonstrate in our daily lives should be carried on to social media as well. Dr. Urban, what advice can you offer with your background in medical education?
I completely echo what Dr. Galati had mentioned. She covered it quite well. From the standpoint of even getting the approval of a patient, I think that when we're dealing with social media and trying to teach utilizing patients' individual records and images and things of that nature, it's very important when we get that approval by the patient, even if it's a signed consent, that it actually be informed consent. The patient should actually know that potentially this could be identified in some way. Dr. Galati pointed out that you don't necessarily even have to have the name or a medical record identifier on there to determine, depending on size of towns and various venues. So I think it's important that when we do utilize patient information, and we do know that whether our institutions allow that or not. Some institutions don't allow it even with informed consent, so it's important to know the institutional variances. But with the patient, I think it's very important that they understand what the potential downstream could be and make sure that they feel comfortable with that. And also just to, I find most of the time when I address it with a patient and I tell them that I'm going to use it as an educational process, they're very happy to be involved with that. But I do let them know that I'm going to do my very best to make sure that they can't be identified, but that, you know, there are things that can happen like this. I think from the standpoint of this exact phenomenon, you know, this is going to require meetings with the patient and with the fellow and with the program director and probably some legal people from one's institution. And I think that this is a great place for some after-action discussion with the patient, with the mea culpa, and making sure that the patient relationship is not broken through this. Social media can be a wonderful tool for us, but it's a double-edged sword, and we have to be quite careful with it. Everything that is put online is there for perpetuity, and we have to be very mindful of that. So I think it's important that just like we would do a timeout for a procedure that we would do a timeout before we hit tweet on something that we've got an image, to make sure that the very last thing that we look at is to make sure that that image was de-identified.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And, you know, this case highlights a scenario where the patient's trust was broken. And I think one of the biggest treasures of a doctor-patient relationship is patient trust and patient confidentiality. So I appreciate you both taking so much time to actually break that down for our audience. So we've covered a great deal of information, but I'd like to also ask you both, what would you recommend program directors and institutions and employers to do in order to make sure that adequate standards of medical professionalism are maintained? And do you know of any resources that our audience can use? Dr. Ilati, what would you suggest?
Well, I think certainly hospitals should have their own code of professionalism, but certainly we started off by saying is that we all took an oath when we became doctors, and our professional societies also have professionalism as part of its core components. The ACC actually has a mock module for medical professionalism online that you can take for mock credit. And I really think that this is something, you know, as we're talking about maybe not always having to write an exam every 10 years, I almost feel like they should have to do medical professionalism every year, because I feel like we shouldn't forget our roots. We shouldn't forget why we're here. We certainly have, with the American Board of Medical Specialties, as I started out, they certainly have some online information about medical professionalism. As I said, the ACC does as well. Additionally, ABIM, American College of Physicians, they all have their principles as well as their 10 commitments that have been proposed by them jointly. And it's good to review them if you haven't done them in a while, just to refresh yourself and know if anything's changed. And I think those are the things that I would use, and I always refer my own trainees and faculty when we've run into problems where we've seen sometimes with our faculty not behaving professionally. We'll, when we're confronting them, actually, we'll bring those in and say, you know, these are part of our core of who we are. Do you see where you missed maybe the place that we're addressing in the situation?
Absolutely, absolutely. Dr. Irvin?
Yeah, I completely agree, and I've gone through those modules again recently, and they're quite excellent. So I would also recommend the MOC modules that you can look at actually free of charge if you're a member of the ACC. We also, in my own institution, when we onboard all of our new physicians, whether that be house staff physicians or senior staff physicians, we have them do a training course called the Art of Communication. And obviously, the basis really of where we go with professionalism has to do with communication. Communication with the patient, communication amongst the team, communication amongst colleagues, all of those sorts of things are going to be very important. But that Art of Communication is actually put out by the Academy of Healthcare Communication, and they have some very excellent resources to use. There are formal training programs that can be used. Train the trainer. As I mentioned before, we have to teach the teachers first. Those that are most senior need to be involved. We need to have everybody having this training in the sense that really we can do modules, we can do all kinds of different things, but if we're not seeing this behavior modeled on a daily basis and that becomes the expectation in an institution, it's not going to take hold amongst our people who are going to be following us up through the pathway of a medical career. So it's very important that they see the senior people modeling and walking the talk, if you will. And so I think that's going to be a huge key for any institution or program.
Absolutely. That's such tremendous insight into the various resources that are out there that one can take advantage of. And it certainly gives me a lot to think about what I need to review to keep my medical professional competencies up to par. And as we perhaps finish off our time on this podcast and wind down, I'd like to end with another question perhaps both of you guys can help answer. What does the future hold for the ACC in regards to medical professionalism and non-clinical competency training?
Well, as you know, the ACC is our professional medical home for the entire cardiovascular team. And as such, we have to uphold the highest level of professional standards, and we have to make sure that we're doing good educational programming to do so. We've got the modules that are there. One of the other things that we should keep in mind is that a combined group of both North American and European internal medicine boards published several years back Medical Professionalism in the New Millennium, a Physician Charter, and the American College of Cardiology ratified that in 2015. There's a really nice article that was published in JAC. It was actually done by Drs. Gordon and O'Gara, as well as one of our Board of Trustees, Deborah Ness. They published this in JAC in 2015, and it's called Medical Professionalism in the American College of Cardiology. It is a great read. It goes through that physician charter. And that physician charter, the main fundamentals of that was, number one, the primacy of the patient welfare, number two, patient autonomy, and number three, social justice. And those are all things that the college strives very hard to do, both on a high level and in terms of very purposeful educational programming. We usually have intensives at our scientific sessions every year, in addition to multiple mentoring and leadership programs within the college. These are our key hallmarks for us in terms of developing the professional rise of our people coming along behind us. And that's not even to mention the competency statements that we publish for our training programs, which also include very specific types of things that we look for in terms of the professionalism competency.
That's impressive. Thank you both so much for your time today. I know I have learned a lot and a great deal from you all. I'm sure this will be very valuable as a foundation for many of our listeners as we consider maintaining medical professionalism. Thank you all that have joined us today for the session of Practice Makes Perfect. We look forward to our next discussion.
This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC. Thanks for joining us today, and please be sure to join us online at acc.org or on iTunes and Google Play to subscribe to Practice Made Perfect. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue our series and keep the conversation going on our new online community, Member Hub, to discuss these topics and any top-of-mind practice issues. Catch you next time to discuss more on how practice really does make perfect.